pronounced in and for the Seventh Judicial Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
A very good morning to everyone. Our first case this morning is number 044305, the United States against Mark P. Heath. Mr. Hildebrandt.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm privileged to appear here as court-appointed counsel for Mark Heath. There's something I would like to have the court consider as I make this argument. Our first issue is that the testifying witness against my client, Mr. Wendt, had a number of convictions that were over 10 years old, and the district judge granted the United States' motion in limine to exclude those convictions for impeachment purposes. But we cited a number of cases in our brief that showed that where credibility is critical, as it was in this case, that those older convictions should be admitted. And I'd like to suggest to the court, if you would, that if the shoe were on the other foot, if my client, Mr. Heath, had been the one who pled guilty and Mr. Wendt were on trial, wouldn't you think that under the authority that we have cited that all of these convictions would have been brought out if Mr. Wendt were the defendant under trial?
See, I think the problem, Mr. Hildebrandt, here is that six of the nine convictions that were admitted to impeach Mr. Wendt did involve theft or bad checks, and the idea is, you know, what additional benefit do you think could have been gained from piling on even older convictions that relate to the same conduct? It just gets to be so cumulative and, you know, sort of somewhat stale.
Well, the same could be said of the convictions involved in case law that were admitted. The first conviction that was not admitted was one from 1989 involving theft of movable property. And, of course, here we have the cars. And one of the convictions that was admitted also involved theft of movable property, to be sure. But I think that under the rule of evidence, the district judge has the responsibility of weighing the probative value of the conviction supported by specific facts and circumstances as to whether it substantially outweighs its prejudicial effect. And the judge essentially, to follow up on Your Honor's question, I think made a cumulative type of determination, which I don't think was appropriate under this rule, because what she was supposed to do is do this weighing that the rule specifically advises a court to do. Now, the problem essentially is that the probative value of the one key critical witness, the impeachment, was extremely high, and there was absolutely no prejudice to the government or, for that matter, to the witness. He had pled guilty and was awaiting sentencing. So once you get to the responsibility of the trial judge to weigh the evidence, to weigh these factors, and say, is there prejudice and all of that, there was no prejudice. So it's our contention that, in fairness, this evidence should have been available for impeachment. Now, I'd also like to spend a minute or two talking about the so-called other acts intricately related point that we raised in our brief. These checks that were found at his brother's house were found on the day that the indictment says the conspiracy started. So obviously the checks, having been found at the brother's house, had been made, and who knows how they got there. The record doesn't reveal that, and there's nothing I can tell the court further than what the record reveals. We shouldn't do that anyway, but anyway, the record shows that these checks were found on the day the alleged conspiracy began, and the conspirator, Mr. Wendt, had no knowledge of these checks. And why then is it appropriate to put this kind of evidence in against my client? It's not intricately related to what he was charged with doing in the indictment. And finally, it's not even within the scope of what the indictment alleged. It's kind of interesting because not only were these checks improperly admitted into evidence, as we've contended in our brief, but then in the pre-sentence report, these checks were used to justify the trial judge's conclusion. She did not make findings, as our contention, but in the pre-sentence report, the jury found that the losses were, or the intended loss was more than $400,000, but if you go beyond that, you need these checks that were found at the brother's house in order to get to the level in the guidelines that the judge implicitly used in sentencing my client. So it is basically our contention that these checks should not have been admitted into evidence, and how they were tied in all of that is sort of a mystery to me as far as the record is concerned. One of the things that was found with the checks is this handwritten note that was similar to a note that was found on Mr. Heath's premises during the search. And as to that handwritten note, Mr. Wendt testified that that was his writing. He also testified that Mr. Heath dictated the note to him. But Wendt also testified that he had no knowledge of these checks. So where does this even fit into the alleged conspiracy between Wendt and Heath to use these checks to buy cars? It just isn't there, Your Honors. Finally, I would like to comment on the sentencing. As this court knows, all the federal courts, both trial and appellate, as well as counsel, who have the responsibility of arguing cases in the Booker era. It's a very interesting period, and I'm sure legal historians will write about it. But this sentence was imposed after this court's decision in Booker, but before the Supreme Court's decision in Booker. And I think the trial judge used a discretionary type of sentencing and imposed a sentence, turning out that the sentence was midway in the guideline range if one would consider the checks found at the brother's house as part of the as part of the relevant conduct. Had those checks not been used, the sentence or the relevant conduct range would have been somewhat lower. But again, the jury did not make any finding that would justify that kind of sentence, and the judge did not make any finding either. And it's our contention that the sentence has to be reversed because it's not supported by adequate findings, nor is it supported by enough in the record to show that the judge really considered the Section 353A factors as we now know the judge should have done. I think that that's all I would like to say in my opening argument. I'm surprised I haven't used up my time, but I would like to save the rest of my time for rebuttal, and I thank the court for its kind attention.
Thank you, Mr. Hildebrand. We'll hear now from Mr. Jaros.
Please the court. Peter Jaros for the United States. Steve Sennett was the attorney below. Your Honor, I'm going to dive right into the first issue regarding the prior felonies that were excluded. In that particular case, as the court's well aware, 609 is a rule of exclusion. In other words, felonies over 10 years old will be excluded unless there's proof that somehow the probative value of these can outweigh the prejudicial effect of having these in there.
You know, in deciding whether to admit convictions, you know, that are more than 10 years old, we all know that a court is required to weigh the prejudice. And what I was wondering is really, what would have been the prejudice here? In other words, Mr. Wen had already pled guilty, so there's no harm to him. There was no unfair prejudice to the government. The crimes involved dishonesty, and so they were probative of Wendt's credibility. Why was there this objection to their admission?
Well, I think, Your Honor, there's really two big things going on. One is that the convictions were 14 to 15 years old, and as a result, stale. If you with the presumption that we're not going to admit felonies that are over 10 years old. I think the import of the rule and the import of the decision is not to make this a trial about the witness. In other words, Mr. Hildebrand had over 9 felony convictions to impeach Mr. Wen. He did impeach him with all those felony convictions. At some point, it just simply becomes a trial about this witness as opposed to the issues at hand. Now, obviously, the credibility of Mr. Wendt was critical, but the question is, was there any harm in excluding those witnesses and following the rule? And there certainly, it would be hard-pressed to make that argument. Mr. Hildebrand would have to say, gosh, okay, the jury convicted him after hearing that he had 9 convictions, but if they would have heard that he had 4 more convictions, then they would have not found him guilty. And the reality is, at some point, those convictions become somewhat, at least from the standpoint of the court, as the court ruled, both prejudicial and certainly the probative value of those older 14- and 15-year-old convictions don't outweigh their probative effect.
You mentioned at page 15 of your brief that Mr. Wendt's testimony was corroborated heavily. Could you expand on that a little bit? Just how do you think it was corroborated?
It was corroborated, Your Honor, by the physical evidence that existed in the case. For example, he talked about the checks. He talked about the plan of what went on. These were then corroborated by the other witnesses that talked about exactly what happened. He admitted to his conduct regarding the notes. Everything that he talked about played out within the physical evidence that existed. And that's really how it is corroborated. And going back and going into those 30 checks that were found at the brother of Mr. Heath's apartment on the 21st, Mr. Wendt, if we can just break them up, Mr. Wendt said, I wrote that note. It explains how the plan got together, explains how the chronology of the conspiracy started to unfold. He said that Mr. Heath dictated that note to me, and I would write down what it said. He then also talked about the fact that virtually the same note is then found in Mr. Heath's apartment on the day of the search. I think it was the 27th. What's important about those 30 checks and why those were properly admitted was that those 30 checks are virtually identical to the same checks that Mr. Heath and Mr. Wendt were passing.
Let me tell you my problem with the government's argument here. In the district court, you seem to argue that the checks that were found at the home of, you know, the allegedly estranged brother were evidence of the charged conspiracy. And now you seem to be arguing that the checks are simply closely related to the crime charged. So what I've been wondering is, do you no longer believe that the checks were part of the charged conspiracy?
No, Your Honor. I think that as a practical matter, you could view those checks, because they're intricately intertwined or intricately interrelated, that those checks are a part and parcel of the entire conspiracy. In other words, that they are in essence both, if you will. Evidence of the intent and planning and how the conspiracy unfolds and the chronology of it, as well as part of the entire conspiracy itself.
Well, I mean, are you in any way arguing that these checks were, in fact, prior bad acts?
Your Honor, the prior bad act argument was only used as an alternative means for admissibility of these. If for some reason those checks could be considered anything outside of an inextricably intertwined events occurring with the conspiracy, then they're certainly prior bad acts. And so that was a backup argument.
But the jury wasn't instructed to limit the use of the evidence, was it?
No, Your Honor, because the court ruled, and the district court ruled, and we still believe, that they're admissible on both bases. In terms of the third argument that the defendant raised regarding the jury instructions, he didn't touch on that on his direct, but I'd only mention that the instructions considered as a whole that talked about considering Mr. Wynn's testimony with greater caution, the fact that the prosecutor brought that up in his opening statement, and the fact that nobody really hid the fact that he was getting this benefit from this deal, all combined as a whole to make the instructions more than adequate and certainly no plain error. In terms of the sentencing in this case, what is critical here is that this court can be assured, or at least have some confidence in the understanding that Judge Crabb's decision in this case was consistent with Booker and the findings and the court's rulings after Booker. Okay. The reason why is because the court, in its statement of reasons, notes that the guideline range is 41 to 51 months. She imposes a sentence, as Mr. Hildebrandt said, right at 48 months, which is basically in the middle of the guidelines. We know that she had to come to the calculation of the loss amount of $876,000 because there's no way to get to that guideline range or to use that guideline range unless you're doing so.
I know, but you know, I mean, my heart really goes out to the district courts because of, you know, what Booker has done. But are you saying that we have the factual findings or conduct that the guideline or that the district court conducted the guideline analysis that we now have to require?
Your Honor, I think if you will, I think that there's a very good argument that can be made that indeed that's what happened. And if you will, for a moment, you have to start with the initial premise that none of the issues involving loss amount or obstruction, which is what Mr. Hildebrandt's arguing about now, were objected to down below. So there wasn't a contested issue regarding either the loss amount or the obstruction of justice issue.
But why would that matter if a judge doesn't make factual findings?
Well, Your Honor,
through the analysis.
Because as the court ruled in Dean, it is the contested issues. Rule 32A1 does not require those on any issue. It requires them on the contested issues. Otherwise, the court, as the Dean court pointed out, the court is then would be required, the district court would be required to double its duties by going through each and every issue, each and every finding, regardless of whether anybody says anything or not. And in the Cunningham decision, which I don't know, and I beg your pardon if I didn't cite that, I'll submit that as a 28J issue. It's a recent November 14th decision. In Cunningham, the court also made it clear that these are only going to be critical when there is going to be a contested issue. Here, there was no contesting either of the loss amount or the obstruction issue. The judge clearly must have found those based upon her adoption of the PSI, which we know occurred because of the findings of the sentence of 48 months.
Yet I notice in your brief you very candidly said we do have the alternative of remand, and indeed made that argument before the argument you just made.
Apparently
you think this is a pretty close call.
Well, Your Honor, I do, and I don't mean I'm not backing away. We do candidly admit that a strict reading of Barrett's, I believe the pronunciation of that case is, that in that decision, the footnote indicates that this court, desires the district courts to make those types of findings so that they can be assured when they're reviewing it, they know what went on, basically. What I am saying, though, that in Barrett's, Dean, and Cunningham, in those cases, it was contested. And we make it clear in our footnote, and perhaps not clear enough, but in that footnote where we talk about Dean, we are making it clear that there was no objection here. And so, if essentially, there was no explicit finding, but can you be assured, or do you know what the court did in this case? And you know what the district court did because the court's sentence reveals it.
If I could change the focus just for a moment, this problem of the evidence of the notes and checks being found at Heath's brother's home, and apparently there is some evidence in the record that the brothers were estranged at the time. Is there any evidence in the record of any connection between Wendt and Heath's brother that would explain the presence of this material?
I'm not aware of anything in the record that explains that, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Your Honors, the four issues that were brought before this court, the first two dealt with the admission of evidence, the third deals with the adequacy of the jury instructions. Neither of the two issues dealing with evidence were an abuse of discretion, and the third issue dealing with the jury instruction certainly was not plain error. The trial court committed no error, and this court can be fully confident that the court's sentence was reasonable and consistent with the Booker and this court's decision interpreting that case. The 3553A factors were addressed. That's pointed out in the brief. She talked about the seriousness of the offense, the things that he did. If there's only one issue that I can tell from the court's discussion and certainly from the record, it might be this finding of the loss. What I'm suggesting, and it would implore the court, is to understand that the sentence itself is evidence of that finding of loss. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Hildebrand has how much time?
6 minutes.
Thank you.
First, I'd like to correct one unintentional misstatement by my opponent. I did not try the case. And I'm not going to tell the court that the result would have been different if I had. I'm just court-appointed on appeal. Anyway, one of the points that my opponent made was that the impeachment with the extra convictions wouldn't have made a difference. And all I would like the court to consider is that we don't know if it would have made a difference or not. The credibility issues here were very significant, and then when you couple that with the fact that the court did not instruct the jury about the fact that Mr. Wendt received benefits as a result of his plea bargain, it on an overall basis it becomes a very serious problem. Now, none of the victims who had received checks for their cars or vehicles ever saw my client. And it is true, of course, that there was some corroborating evidence found at my client's home or place of business, whatever. But in this kind of a case, and when the indictment is analyzed and the guilty verdict comes in as to what exactly my client was charged with, then I think it's readily apparent that the credibility between Heath and Wendt is an extremely important issue, which, of course, the jury is entitled to determine. But in order to determine that, I think the jury should have the full deck of cards, so to speak, to look at, and that was not done here. My opponent talked about other acts, evidence, the checks being evidence of intent and planning, and I would respectfully disagree with that because there was no evidence really tying either Heath or Wendt to those checks.
Of course, it didn't help matters, did it, when Mr. Heath tried to eat the checks?
Well, that wasn't one of the checks that I'm talking about. I'm talking about the checks at the brother's house. That's what I was referring to. There was nothing in the record that tied Mr. Heath to those checks or how they got to the house or how they were made or anything other than the similarity of it. Finally, the United States candidly admitted in its brief that, and I'm looking at page 26, where they said that that Judge Crabb did not make specific findings regarding the loss amount and obstruction enhancement. And, of course, I'm not critical of anybody here, but I think that before people are sentenced with enhancements, it's important to make findings, and Mr. Heath, my client, stood on his innocence, and therefore the judge should have made findings. Thank you very much for listening to my argument. It's always a privilege to appear before this court.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hildebrand, as you did serve by appointment to the court, and you have the deep thanks of the court for your fine efforts on behalf of your client.
Thank you.
Indeed, our thanks to both counsel in the case. The case will be taken under advisement.